Brigid cradled her coffee cup in both hands with her elbows on the table in the main Cerberus commissary.
I wonder just how much Orion knew.
Grant sat peering down into the opaque blackness of his own coffee, as if he suspected something might be swimming beneath its surface.
Why do you say that?
She knew a great deal about what goes on in the Baronies. A disconcerting amount, frankly, although she certainly seemed to back up her professions of sympathy to our cause with genuine actions, not to mention risks. But I can't help wondering how much of the real truth she knows.
You mean like about the hybrids?
Yeah.
Listen, Brigid, I'm not sure we know anything like the real truth. I'm dead sure we don't know anywhere near the whole story.
No doubt you're right.
Once we think we got the truth nailed down, everything gets turned on its head or inside out. Seems every few months we find out everything we knew for sure was wrong. But that's not what's really eating at you.
So you're a trained psychologist now?
Maybe. Us mags were mostly trained up as door kickers, blunt instruments, just the way you always seem to think Kane and I are.
I don't think of either of you as blunt.
Whatever. But we did do some investigative work. And you do know Kane and I were good at what we did. We made a point of it, and we were on the job for a lot of years. So I learned a little about reading people. Enough to know that your getting pissy with me was another stab at getting around answering my question. So I'm not offended or anything.
Brigid scowled briefly, then her face relaxed, and she emitted a brief, brittle laugh.
Very well. It's the Aborigines.
They're nothing like the people you told us about, nor Domi or Shizuka. Well, not much, anyway.
There are similarities. The way they move, the way they carry themselves. And, of course, we didn't interact closely with any except Yindi, who is no doubt not exactly typical. But still...
She shook her head. Her unbound hair, gleaming red gold from a recent shower, swept back and forth across her shoulders like a horse's tail.
They seem to be typical pre-literates, what were called primitive long ago. Now, part of the time, they act the same way, very tribal. Other times, it's as if we're primitives, and they're trying their best to humor us.
They're good sports about it, though.
So you see it, too?
He nodded. Upon their eerily painless jump back to the Cerberus armory, Grant and Brigid had headed for their quarters to get changed and cleaned up. Though Bushbaby Bob had grumpily insisted he was all right, but for a few cuts and bruises, and a quick but thorough examination by Rita had established he had suffered no visible major damage, his three fellows had insisted on accompanying him to the infirmary. Subsequently, Reba Dufour had called Brigid on the intercom, just as the archivist stepped out of the shower, to tell her that she had put Bushbaby Bob under sedation to get him to rest, and that his friends had asked her to arrange a meeting between them and Brigid and Grant to discuss their new search strategy. Sally Wright turned up just ahead of the three Aborigines. Brigid suspected that in some abstract way she ought to feel threatened by the new arrival, who, after all, was supposed to be a wizard archivist in her own way. Yet what Brigid mostly felt was relief. She would be somebody to share the burdens Lakesh placed upon his longtime protégé. Many of the Moonies were highly intelligent and excruciatingly educated, a fact they seldom let anybody forget, but they also tended to be resentful, refractory. Nor did Brigid altogether trust them. Whereas the escapee from Snakefishville Historical Division was diffident, eager, and, yes, grateful for her deliverance, so much so that Brigid found it impossible to resent her. It didn't occur to Brigid Baptiste that perhaps she was by nature ill-suited to resentment. She was also ill-suited to that kind of self-examination. Smiling and nodding a shy greeting, Sally went to draw tea, asking first if either Brigid or Grant needed anything, which made Grant's head snap up and his eyes regard her narrowly, as if suspecting a trap, before he declined. The three Aborigines came in, got their own refreshments, and joined the others at their corner table. Grant sat with his back to the wall. The Aborigines had recovered some of their ebullience. Billy Handsom slipped into a chair beside Brigid.
The wildest jaunt we've been on yet.
She gave him a quick, sharp look. She wasn't exactly overused to receiving sexual attention, despite the fact that she had been assured over and over by a frankly bizarre assortment of people since fleeing Cobaltville that she was highly attractive, which had made Philboyd's clumsy persistence so trying for her. But while she would be first to admit she was anything but expert in scoping out signs of sexual scrutiny, she was as sure that the talker had no more sexual interest in her than if she were a log or a dog. She hadn't glimpsed anything false lurking behind the trio's almost wearying affability. But she did get the feeling, from Billy's grin and nod of greeting, quick, firm eye contact, then his attention marched away forthrightly elsewhere, that something lay behind it. Not contempt, certainly not disdain. Perhaps condescension. Rita and Nobby agreed heartily.
I'm happy we all made it out intact, leaving aside a few patches of Bush Baby Bob's hide, which'll grow back, right as rain.
She was looking at Grant when she spoke, and there was nothing covert about her interest in the big man. At first touch, that puzzled Bridget, since it was Billy Handsome who was, after all, professionally friendly and charismatic. Then, primarily by force of intellect, Bridget made herself realize that there was no intrinsic identity between job or team role and personal inclinations. Whatever reservations Billy may have had about their North American comrades of convenience, Rita clearly didn't share. When it came to Grant, anyway. To her own surprise, Bridget had to hide a quick grin behind her coffee cup.
I wonder what she'd make of Shizuka.
I don't understand what those people were about. How they came about, if you know what I mean.
Grant studied him from under lowered brows.
Don't have much experience in the Outlands, do you?
Don't have the like back in Oz. A few scattered settlements descended from the colonists, who granted aren't what you'd call well off. Nothing like that, though.
Bridget looked at him.
The vision Yindi showed us indicated that the Puranipa had been wiped out by the nuke cost and its aftermath.
Billy Handsome's reddish-brown eyes widened ever so slightly. He started to answer, then looked pointedly at Rita. The blonde-dreaded young woman was gazing frankly at Grant, who was ignoring her. Possibly he wondered what she'd make of Shizuka, too, or perhaps more to the point, what Nuedo's de facto Lady Shogun would make of her. But the Farwalker instantly picked up her talker's nonverbal cue, so quickly, in fact, that Bridget suspected some sense in play beyond the customary five.
Yindi showed you a glimpse of the Dreamtime, what he called Jacorpa, right?
Bridget nodded. Rita held up her hands, surprisingly large and strong-looking for a woman's hands, enough to give Bridget, really looking at them for the first time, a twinge of inadequacy, as if trying to draw words out of air. The archivist in Bridget was instantly fascinated by what that evidenced about the Aborigines' roles. Farwalker Rita had the most extensive lore, where her people were concerned, but didn't always have the talker's fluency in putting it into words. Or, at least, words, Bridget thought ruefully, sipping her strong black drink and feeling its warmth suffuse her tongue, we can understand.
Jacorpa is true. It's our core truth, you might say. Yet, you can't take it necessarily as literal truth, especially if you're an outsider. So you might consider what you saw, the waves sweeping the land clean of the Piranipa.
Tsunami never got near that height, even with the Rabaul eruption, especially what with New Guinea to take the brunt and all.
You might consider that allegory, metaphorically true, in that the nuke cost did break the back of the colonial domination.
So, anyway, you were about to explain your theory about those curious blokes in the basement there, Dr. Baptiste.
It's Bridget, please. It strikes me that the Madison campus of the University of Wisconsin offered plenty of underground space, relatively safe. Groundwater level is high. We encountered plenty enough seeping in. The faculty members, I suspect, naturally felt reluctant to leave the familiar, comforting confines of academia, especially once the world blew up.
What'd they do for food?
I guess they were already accustomed to living off the student body.
Now it was Sally's turn to experience his slit-eyed look. To her credit, and Bridget's surprise, she didn't quail.
You're joking, right?
No, I don't think so. It makes a twisted sort of sense.
No wonder I never decide to up and leave this crazy outfit. I'd still be in this crazy world.
Would you leave it if you could, Grant?
Eventually I will. Feet first, just like everybody.
Rita smiled.
Perhaps not everybody.
Baron Thulia stared at the screen.
At least there are no cats.
Erica Van Sloan stared at him with dark eyes hard as tungsten carbide drills.
What?
All that was visible on the communicator was her face and mane of black hair. Thulia waved a soft, fine hand around the bedchamber he had been assigned by the Dewa Raja's chamberlain.
The God King's palace at Kuching was overrun with cats. I developed a most intense allergy to the filthy, skulking little beasts.
Your ineffectuality continues to expand my appreciation of the possible, Thulia. All that your vaunted hybrid intelligence has served to accomplish thus far is the discovery that cats make you sneeze.
How dare you speak to me in that tone, you human!
You know how I dare. What makes you think you dare to talk back to me? Remember, for instance, who it was who knew of the existence of a barony of your cousins in the South Pacific.
His cheeks burned so hot he feared again he might have contracted fever. It wouldn't be surprising. Barons paid for their enormous superiority with compromised immune systems. They all knew and understood that, and this humid hothouse was nothing but a greenhouse for pestilence. It was a miracle even the Apekin with their brutish animal vitality didn't succumb in droves. At least the God King had seen fit to give him a spacious and suitably appointed chamber, one set high up in the palace, which itself sat atop a hill overlooking city and harbor. While it made for an inconvenient amount of climbing, Thulia was fairly certain the Dewa Raja could move between floors without deigning to tramp up and down stairs, but if he possessed such means, he hadn't revealed them to Thulia. It also meant he was well up out of the concentrated odors of mere humanity, which to Thulia's mind and nose were sweat, rancid body oils, and of course, shit. With the wind in off the sea and the windows opened, with even fine mesh metal screens to keep out the most pernicious insects, the breeze blowing through the bedchamber with its whitewashed walls and silk caparisoned bed was cool and fresh, or almost so.
Perhaps we ask too much of you, Thulia. Therefore, I have decided to help you.
His head snapped up.
You mean the barons have agreed to recall me?
Not at all. I am dispatching the best operator from my magistrate division, one Vladek, one of the few surviving contemporaries of the hated renegade Cain. He will be at your entire disposal.
Meaning, Thulia knew, the vat bastard Apekin will follow my command so far as they do not conflict with her secret instructions to him.
This will allow you to employ your vaunted intellect to full effect while Vladek supplies all necessary spine and balls. Erica Van Sloan speaking for the Nine, out.
Her image dissolved into a whirl of colored fog, then emptiness. Smiling gently, almost sadly, Billy Handsome came back from replenishing his tea and up from behind and laid a hand on the arm of his farwalker. He spoke quietly to her in their language. His normally boisterous affect was subdued. Rita nodded matter-of-factly.
The ghoul specialized right quick. 2 centuries is not very long for those kinds of physical divergences to take hold.
As always, when he had something technical to discuss, he came alive, even out of himself. He held his head up and looked you in the eye, if briefly, when he spoke. But Bridget noted that his conception of what was technical was different from hers and most of her peers. For instance, general history seemed to lie in his area of specialization, along with physical, scientific theory, and knowledge of gadgets. The specific history of the people, the crew, as they had referred to themselves once or twice, which apparently covered all aborigines of whatever tribe or lineage, was Rita's province. So was more esoteric theory. Yet when the Farwalker discussed details of what it was she did, the limiting factor was Bridget's limited capacity to understand, a difficulty, she had been assured, that would be not noticeably less severe were Rita talking to Lakesh himself. Bridget couldn't restrain herself from a private smile now, over the rim of her cup, as she raised the fragrant fluid toward her lips and felt its heat shine on her mouth, envisioning anybody, even old man, trying to tell that to Dr. Mohandas Lakesh Singh. Nabi, for his part, seemed to enjoy a frankly mystical communion with machines, an almost empathic sense of how to make them work and what was wrong with them when they did not. It's almost as if the left-brain, right-brain divisions we're used to don't operate in them, she thought, or perhaps they operate differently. She came out of her reverie. Sally Wright was talking about limited gene pools and a kind of high-energy natural selection.
They had their own evolving culture. And from what you've said, it evolved into something more than a little strange, which applied selection pressures of its own.
She noticed Bridget looking at her, stopped, blushed, fluttered, and then looked hard at the table with her gray-blue eyes.
I'm sorry if I'm speaking out of place. I got carried away, I guess. It only looks to me as if you're doing the very thing you were brought here for. No need to apologize for that.
All this is quite fascinating, but I trust you'll forgive me if I none so subtly steer us back to the issue at hand. Which is, Bridget tells us she has a suggestion as to how to proceed that doesn't involve mucking about in places like that ghastly basement. Which I, for one, am all in favor of.
To raw it. Simply, I believe it is more efficient to search records than shelves.
Great idea. You'll have to forgive us. We're new to this looting cultural relics game. All we know is what we've learned from having it done to us.
But we've been looking through records in the places we've been. All our teams, that is.
But they're fragmentary when you find them at all. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
The ones you find have suffered all manner of damage. Looting, vandalism, fires, paper decaying to nothing through simple age. You probably find water damage has rendered a lot of the records you locate illegible. All true. And the computer records aren't much better. I suspect you have your own portable power supplies, but I doubt that you find many working computer systems with uncrashed hard disks, and very little by way of backups, such as tapes and CDs.
Nobby reared back in his seat, blinking through his bottle-bottom lenses.
But that's exactly right. Find bugger all most places. Pardon the language, ma'am.
Not least of the mysteries about these people was not that they spoke the language of their colonial oppressors, but they spoke it with the very accent of their oppressors, not to mention the idioms that had been current in the years before the nuke cost. Perhaps that was just the form in which their only common tongue survived. She nodded to Billy Handsome.
You spoke of looting cultural relics not long ago. The people I used to work for were in the business of doing precisely that, to the remnants of our own North American culture. Since unification, the baronies have combed the continent for all the records and stored data on pre-Nukecost America they could get their hands on. Most of the places you visited have probably been cleaned out already 70 years ago.
Crikey.
We have been looking in the baronies, though, remember?
Sure. They're storerooms. Same problems of inefficiency, if a great deal neater setting. And the risks, if anything, greater.
As we know to our sorrow.
But we've searched the databases in the monoliths when we've gotten in.
And found not much, I suspect.
Nobby hunched his head down on his neck and tipped it to the side.
Well, more than you might expect. We've got our own software, good as your NEMA sign, courtesy of old man.
Still smiling, Billy said something in their language. Nobby blinked and let his shoulders slump. Bridget surmised it amounted to quit showing off. Billy looked back to Bridget.
So, what is it you're proposing, then?
We have our own copies of virtually every byte the baronies got their hands on in our mass storage right here in Cerberus. And we can search it without having to play who's his biggest games with encryption and decryption software.
Nobby blushed a bright red Bridget hadn't suspected he was capable of.
Nor, for that matter, to worry about magistrates kicking in the door to serve termination warrants on you. Or us. Sally Wright, if she's willing.
Oh, yes, by all means.
The thin-faced woman seemed flattered at being included.
And I will search for mention of the turtle. You're welcome to help as long as you're willing to undertake not to probe too deeply into our secrets. Our own encryption was written to defeat even the sign. And please don't take that as a challenge, Nobby.
He won't.
He pushed back from the table.
Well, I'm up to start the search, especially since it seems to entail a marked lack of cannibal interlopers. Who's with me?
Bridget looked to Sally. The Snakefishville fugitive's cheeks shone pink, and her eyes were actually bright.
I think we're good.
All rose except for Grant. He turned to face Billy Handsome.
Question.
Ask Freddy, Mike.
Why are you sneaking around machine shops if what you're looking for is an ancient statue of a turtle? Or is all that just Mag Division intel with their heads wedged up their butts again?
Oh no, Mike. They got that right. We've been whipping up a kit, you see.
Kit?
Gear. The rough and ready. Equipage, as the French might say.
How do you know what the French might say?
He knows every language.
For just an instant, Billy Handsome's well-named face hardened. Then he flashed a smile again.
Now, Nobby, don't go exaggerating the way you do. As to your question, Cobber, we're remembering, as you might say, how to build all kinds of wizard stuff from our own dim, dark past. But I dare say you've seen the photos around about Uluru. The center of our existence, yes. The cradle of our being, to be bloody sure. But bugger all in terms of halfway modern fabrication facilities.
You're building those beam weapons.
Billy nodded.
In part. They come in right handy, as you've seen. But mainly we've been lashing together the means of making tools to make better tools. Including neutron blasters that don't give the Pharaoh a lethal dose of radiation after just a few shots.
In the sudden deathly silence that filled the commissary, all heads turned to Nobby.
Those nearby get far less exposure. But you might want to get checked out when you have a spare moment.
What?
Nobby stammered in response to the continued scrutiny from all three Cerberus people.
No worries about me. It's only this body after all.
Are you sure you won't take a little mulled wine? I can heat some right up. The wizened old man in the skull cap and indigo gown bent over a little hearth inset in the sweating stone wall of the underground room. Kane successfully struggled to control a reflex grimace.
No, thank you, Mr. Goldstein. Cold water's fine for me.
The AKM that had been aimed at Kane's navel when the door opened had been held in the wood-brown and wood-hard hands of one Sala, a small, flat-faced man in a dark sarong and a fez. He was the owner-proprietor of a crack-in-the-wall shop selling herbs and powders and various equipment for use in rituals of various sorts, as far as Kane could judge, from a quick glance around in the dim orange light cast by a single brass lamp slung from the ceiling by chains. The narrow space, Kane could have spanned it by extending his arms to his sides, was dominated by a stuffed narrow-snouted crocodilian also hung from the roof beams. Yet Sala had a partner, one normally invisible to the public, although, as he was demonstrating now, definitely not silent. Reuven Goldstein was the Aborigine's contact with Tanimbar City. One of them, anyway, Kane thought. It was abundantly clear to him now that the vision Brigid and the rest had been vouchsafed by Yindi was incomplete. Perhaps not entirely false, but a far shout from the whole truth. Just as, for instance, it would have been obvious that commerce in goods and info, smuggling, espionage, call it what you will, had been ongoing between the Aborigines and the Islanders for years, if not right along since the nuke cost. The sort of contact that just didn't seem to fit into the vision of the Aborigines as happy organic people who did little but hunt and gather and dance around naked. No more than the quartet of flesh-and-blood Aborigines who were crammed into the low-ceilinged space beneath the creaky floorboards of Sala's shop fit that image.
Let me offer you something to eat.
The bent old man tinkled a small brass bell. In response, a little brown child in a blue sarong and fez appeared with a plate of fruit, which Domi, murmuring thanks, fell to devouring with her customary rapacity. The others declined. Goldstein teetered over and sat on a three-legged stool at the table.
You may be wondering, my North American friends, at finding a Jew here in the East South Sea Islands. The story is simple enough. Christianity came. Now it's gone, in these parts at least. Islam came and went. The dominant religion in the islands now is a blend of animism and vaguely Hindu-influenced polytheism. And us, God's chosen people, suffering on.
The Aborigines sat silent, their usual ebullience drained. Cain reckoned it was sheer fatigue.
How come your people have stuck it out?
The little man in the yarmulke shrugged.
Plenty of my people would argue with this. But then, that's the way we are. I think it's because of our essential pessimism.
The power of negative thinking, huh?
Exactly. You see, Christianity and Islam made promises. Specifically, they predicted Armageddon, with redemption to follow.
He gestured around, a sweeping movement that implicitly took in all the world around them.
Armageddon we got, in trumps and spades. But redemption? That's been a little scarce, as you've no doubt noticed. We Jews, on the other hand, while we harbor notions of a Messiah, where do you think the Christians got it from? Don't necessarily expect him at any given moment. We should be so lucky that he would come while we walk the earth. Whereas our God promised us plenty of suffering, and this he has always delivered. So when the Battle of Armageddon was followed not by the rule of the righteous, but the world basically turning into shit for 200 years, the newcomers got disillusioned. For us Jews, it was more of the same.
So how come? Speak English.
That, too, is simplicity itself, my dear young lady. Well before the new cost, English had established itself as the language of international trade. Non-Jews remained obstinate about not learning Hebrew. Hereabouts, you'll find that while few of the common people understand English, the majority of the merchants and traders do, not to mention the functionaries of the God-King, inasmuch as English is the language of his court.
Speaking of this God-King, how exactly does he fit in?
Exceedingly well. The people, you see, believe as they have for millennia that the gods are real. They believe the gods have loves and rivalries and even kill one another. They believe mortals can be apotheosized into gods, and gods incarnated as mortals. Don't you think maybe the Christians craved a little something of that, Never mind. When the God King's silver disk appeared in the skies and burned up all those who would not bow down in worship to him with its ruby fire flashes, sure, it was beyond the experience of most of the populace, but it was nothing out of line with their theological expectations.
So he's been trying to suppress other religions.
Goldstein drank deeply from his battered tin tankard, clunked it down on the table before himself, and wiped his beard with the back of his hand.
Mostly, no. This is where we, God's chosen people, get screwed again. As I said, my boy, to most of the pious pagans around here, all gods are real. The Deva Raja would not try to suppress belief in the others, because that no one would sit still for. But he can make a go at forcing everybody to worship him as primary god, at least of the region. Because, after all, the public sees that as natural. He's a god, he's also a king. Why shouldn't he insist on being number one? It's what anybody would do, no?
But you won't worship him.
Domi sat back and licked her fingers. The beaten brass platter was bare, save for a few stems and rinds. Not for the first time, Kane marveled at the disconnect between her gammon slimness and horde of locusts' appetite. Goldstein's dark old eyes glittered at her.
And how did you know that, young lady?
We had Jews living in the Ville for a while. They traveled around a bunch. Everybody thought they were funny, because nobody else had much use for religion. But nobody bothered them about that. Other stuff.
Religious prejudice and race hatred aren't big in the Nine Baronies these days. People have basically found more pressing things to get excited about, like muties.
As you say, I will not bow before the Deva Raja. Therefore, I find it expedient to take a partner, as in my excellent friend Sala, whom you met upstairs, to serve as front man. Plus, I must add, he's very industrious. But all this, too, shall pass. Even as great world religions and philosophies like communism enjoy their day in the sun and die, so must God kings do, don't you think?
Kane placed his big, scarred hands on the table and grinned through his beard. He didn't realize what a sign it was of the feeble little old man's courage that Goldstein didn't quail. With his already more than somewhat slightly sinister face underlit by the butter-colored flicker of a wick in a brass basin of oil, he looked altogether demonic.
And that is exactly what we want to talk about.
Domi complained as she and Kane strolled side by side through the morning crowds toward the great Slave Mart Plaza near the Tanimbar City waterfront.
I don't like these clothes. Double hot in here.
Quit bitching. It's hot in the Outlands where you come from, too.
But it's a dry heat.
Kane rolled a wolf-gray eye at her in a don't-start-with-me look. He couldn't see her answering expression for her veil, but he suspected it was a rebellious grin. Despite her dissatisfaction with her Sidiak garb, which Kane had to acknowledge was no doubt less than comfortable, she was doing her best to fit in, at least when it came to walking with the almost exaggerated hip-swinging gait the local women displayed, since even the ones who were far from fat possessed much more imposing hips than the slender albino girl, she was definitely playing catch-up. But then, as Kane had long known, vanadium steel was as custard to the will of Domi. He only feared she might cause herself serious lumbar spinal injury with the extraordinary convolution she was putting her pelvis through. Tanimbar City was at once shabbier and more magnificent in the molten light of day. You could really see its extent, the big mansions and palaces and public structures with their whitewashed walls blinding in the sun, their gilded domes and minarets, which, their original function having been misplaced, along with widespread observance of Islam, were still maintained as watchtowers and places from which alarm could be sounded with gongs and brass horns should the horizon suddenly sprout the mustard and blood-hued sails of a pirate fleet. But you could also see the slums, precarious structures, some of which rose 3 and even 4 stories, despite the fact you could see where stucco had flaked away in so many places that they were nothing more than some lathwork frames jumbled together with thin lattices and daubed over with mud. It seemed to be mostly the act of leaning against one another that held them up, and some leaned unnervingly out over streets that were mostly too narrow and shady already, while some bulged like plaster hernias. Kane refused even to contemplate what would happen when one of the region's inevitable earthquakes slammed into town for a visit, or someone inevitably got a little careless with one of the ubiquitous open fires or bowls of coals everybody used for cooking. Things would go up as if they were drenched in high octane. Then again, Baptiste had told him Shizuka's people, a people long famed for cleverness and industry, had always chosen to live in houses of paper and wood, heated with their own charcoal pots, despite dwelling on a cooler northerly arc of this selfsame seismically unstable ring of fire. And more, many of them preferred to do so during the brief high-tech interregnum of the 20th century, when they actually had alternatives. Even though the streets were thronged with energy, noise, and life, and movement, faces and limbs of all shades, not excluding Domi's pigmentless pallor, and countless languages, including spindrift snatches of English, there was a quality here that Kane could feel and hear and see, but not quite put a name to. Not hopelessness, which was so common in the scummy outland villes or the Tartarus pits, or, he now recognized, in the gleaming enclave towers in different form. But something not too far distant. Fatalism, perhaps. Then, of course, in the daylight, you could better see the dirt. But his nose had brought him that bad news in abundance last night. Fortunately, his olfactory sense was giving up the unequal battle and growing numb to the stinks. He resolved to be careful to wash carefully anything he ate, keep an eye on Domi to make sure she did the same, and be silently thankful that people who had survived the megacull tended to be highly disease-resistant. He was also thankful that Defoe had insisted on giving them both broad-spectrum antibiotic shots, product of another secret totality concept project, before allowing Mary Alice to whisk them off to Babar Island.
Goldstein says the God King's not so bad, even if he does want Jews to worship abominations. But he scared off pirates and made it safe for traders.
Kane shrugged. He was dressed as a pirate himself again today. He was actually starting to like the getup. He assured himself it was only because of the freedom allowed his limbs by the loose blouse and trousers. Sure, that was it.
Has a different feel from the enclaves of the pits. A lot looser, easier. He doesn't seem to have tried to clamp the same iron restraints on behavior his cousins back in North America did. Maybe because he lacked the resources.
Or maybe because people wouldn't go along with it.
Maybe so. Baptiste tells me Americans used to be known for their contrariness and independent ways. Don't see that much anymore.
Maybe more before the Barons. There were some back in the days of Baron Blasters, and some now. What about Maureen Orion? Or me?
Okay, point made. Although I can tell you from my experience that there's plenty of people, and not just sealed away in nice, clean, climate-controlled enclaves, who can't imagine any kind of life beyond meekly waiting to be told what to do and doing it. The point is, even if this Baron has made the trains run on time around here, he's still on the other side from us.
Sure.
Ahead of them, the crowd abruptly parted. There was no change in the timbre of the polyglot babble or even any visible disturbance. The mob simply flowed left and right to let a pair of men swagger through. A remarkable pair they were, too. Big men, powerfully built, their already imposing heights exaggerated by turbans that had to have been a foot wide wound around their skulls. They wore silken tunics with double lines of gleaming gold buttons down the bibs, loose pantaloons, sturdy roll-topped leather boots. Silken veils hid all their faces except their restless, suspicious eyes. And every square inch of cloth was lustrous, raven-wing black. The only items they displayed that weren't jet black were the gold-chased silver scabbards and gold-pommeled ivory hilts of the sabers bouncing at their waists, and the kreese strapped to each man's left forearm. Their eyes, one pair brown, one pair blue, swept over Domi and Kane. They didn't so much as pause. The instant the pair passed, the crowd flowed back into one seamless stream about them, just like water. Domi turned her head, and her gesture was unmistakable, even through her veil.
Mags.
Too right, as our Aboriginal friends would say. I don't believe it. Son of a bitch has got himself a low-tech magistrate division.
Triple shits. You right all along. This Baron, enemy of everything good.
Before them, two- and three-story commercial buildings of clearly more durable construction than the tenements, pink-washed brick and even stone, fell away to either side to reveal the Slave Mart Plaza. A hectare of smooth and gleaming concrete, near as Kane could figure it, bordered on three sides by splendid warehouses and assorted public structures. The fourth side lay open to the docks, and beyond it, the harbor, water invisible beneath a dense incrustation of hull and masts tugging at the fearfully blue sky above, and all dominated by the ormolu bulk of the Varuna. Vast as it was, the plaza was totally full of spectators, packed bung to chinklepin. The God King hadn't suppressed slavery itself. According to Goldstein's matter-of-fact account, that would never have been accepted by the population. He had squatted on the slave trade, however. The court held a monopoly on slave ownership, although mercantile concerns and even individuals could lease slaves from the God King. Citizens both rich and well-disposed toward the divine monarchy, Cain guessed. Enslavement was primarily a leading form of criminal punishment. Fines, floggings, and public execution, being the popular alternatives, and non-governmental seizure and trafficking in slaves was prohibited on pain of decapitation. Which meant, as far as Cain could see, that the God King's goons, his fleet, army, and his mags held a monopoly on slaving. But no amount of enforcement, no matter how swift or atrocious the penalties exacted, could entirely end freelance slaving, any more than it could the prevalent piracy and smuggling. Cain didn't really understand the system, but when Goldstein got through telling them that part, Domi and the four Aborigines were already asleep, and Cain had learned more than he actually cared to know. At the far end from the docks rose a set of viewing stands of some kind of smooth white stone. A better-dressed audience occupied these. The stands were dominated by a grand central pavilion, narrow but almost two stories tall, of some white material, possibly stone as well, carved into a fine latticework, which had the effect of admitting air and allowing the occupants to see out, but making it impossible to see into the interior in any detail.
Bastards watching from in there, bet.
No bet.
Before the stands rose a broad dais. Wide marble steps mounted it to either side. It was the old auction block where the slaves had been sold. Cain was surprised at its magnificence, given there had probably been no practical way of keeping the slaves from crapping all over it, not to mention bleeding. Maybe marble was easy to clean, and anyway, conspicuous consumption was apparently not considered a serious faux pas in this part of the world.
What happened?
Cain had been scanning the gigantic buildings fronting upon the plaza, occupied with figuring fields of view and possible escape routes.
I think one guy just gouged the other's eyes out.
The slave block now served as a battle platform. So many had flocked to Tanimbar City to join the God King's Holy Expeditionary Force to Australia as mercenaries that aspirants to officer rank had to prove their mettle in single combat against one another. If the loser survived more or less intact, as the one contestant had evidently just failed to do, he could stay in the ranks as a grunt. Winners got promoted. And if the winner stayed in, higher rank came with each additional round, with growing prizes to sweeten the pot. Of course, the longer a competitor stayed in, the greater his chances of death and dismemberment. That's what made it entertainment.
Which guy gouged his eyes out?
Dude with four arms?
Kane's eyes snapped at the dais. A figure in a loincloth knelt on the marble top, weeping copious amounts of blood through cupped hands. Above him, the victor, 7 feet tall, as near as Cain could make it, and clad only in billowy white pantaloons, now liberally sprayed with red, brandished his arms, all four of them, in triumph over his head, which was shaved bare except for a horsetail-length black topknot. Domi moved in close, pitching her voice low and urgent.
Cain, are you sure you know what you're doing?
No.
How are you doing?
Sally Wright looked up and around quickly, something like fear on her face. The tall redhead patted her shoulder reassuringly.
Sorry. I wouldn't have believed that one could lose that fear when I had been out as short a time as you have. But I guess I have begun to forget what it's like to spend my time dreading who might be reading what over my shoulder.
The new archivist gave her a shy grin.
You mean I don't have to feel bad about being jumpy?
I don't think you have to feel bad about anything.
Dotted throughout the expanse of Cerberus Redoubt were large and small compartments subdivided into cubicles containing desks with computer workstations. With its brutal devotion to the concept of order, and domination, of course, the totality concept would not be denied its bureaucracy, to judge by the amount of space dedicated to the task. Since all the computers were tied into the same local area network, it was only a matter of possessing the proper passwords to perform any task you desired. Although Bridget didn't know all the passwords, Lakesh was far too fond of playing his cards close to the vest for that, She knew more than enough to get them to the relatively low-clearance collection of nuke-cost records purloined from the Barony's databases. Although sheer fortitude and the pressure of the mission had enabled them to suppress it during their brief and nearly disastrous foray into the basements of what had been University of Wisconsin, the Australians shared a mild claustrophobic streak. In particular, they found the weight of the vanadium alloy and concrete of Cerberus, and the bulk of the peak beneath which it was buried, to be disconcerting. That wasn't odd in Bridget's eyes. After all, they had passed their whole lives to date beneath the unbounded starry skies of the island continent. What was odd was that they seemed annoyed and impatient with their own unease at being cooped up beneath a mighty mass of metal and stone. As if that in itself were somehow unexpected, although to Bridget it seemed the most natural thing on Earth. Unwelcome surprise or not, the psychic unease was real and present to some degree in all four. So Bridget had staked out a relatively open corner of the largest and most spacious area of Cerberus workstations.
I haven't turned up anything beyond tantalizing hints yet. I only wish I could scan through the files as fast as they do.
Bridget's gaze followed Sally's nod to where the four Aborigines sat, each at a monitor. Screens of data flickered past, none slower than one a second. Even Bushbaby Bob, his head turbaned in bandages, was taking his turn.
We all do what we can, I guess.
She walked over to stand beside Billy Handsome.
Don't mean to intrude.
Not a problem.
The talker turned his red dreadlocked head aside to flash a smile at her. The screens continued to flick past. Obviously, he was reading them with his peripheral vision.
You're all, how should I say this, prodigiously talented.
This? Oh, don't be too impressed. It's a trick, mostly.
Could you teach it to me?
For once, Billy showed his teeth in an expression other than a smile. His full lips made a sort of oval around his teeth.
Yeah, not so easy. You don't rightly have the reference, I'm afraid. But if we get a chance when we're done with this, when we got the turtle back to Lilga, we'll teach you what we can. Fair enough?
I suppose so. But there's something that's been bothering me. When I went to Uluru before, what I saw struck me very strongly as, well, a non-literate culture.
At mention of the word Uluru, the other three stopped what they were doing and pivoted to look at her. Their relaxed affability never flickered, but something more had entered the mix. Reverence? Expectancy?
You mean you thought we couldn't read? Well...
No worries, Bridget. We couldn't.
Bridget stared at him.
Sally!
Nobby lunged to the refugee archivist's side. The woman sat quivering stiff in her chair, arms down and locked at full extension, hands knotted into fists so hard the bones threatened to tear through the skin on the backs of her hands. Her face was paper white. Her lips, completely bloodless, writhed, but no sound came out.
Seizure? No.
She knelt at the stricken woman's other side. Nobby had already drawn back at her gently insistent air-pushing gesture, so as not to add the pressure of presence to whatever stress load was jamming the woman's system. The talker looked up at her companions.
Vision.
She'll come to no harm, but a cup of cool water and a towel would help.
Bridget complied instantly. Her long years of training in rigid self-control paid off now, as did several years' experience of real bone-busting, blood-spurting emergencies out in the big bad world. Moving precisely, but without apparent hurry, she brought the objects Rita requested. She took off Sally Wright's glasses and began to wipe her brow as Rita applied paper towels soaked in ice water to the insides of her wrists. Then Rita took one still rock-hard fist in her own strong square hand, began to stroke the underside of the wrist while murmuring words unknown to Bridget. There was nothing evident in face, posture, or action but concerned compassion, yet the impression Bridget could not shake away was of a human worried about a beloved pet. Slowly, as if being cranked, Sally's fist began to open. It got about a quarter of the way, and then simply relaxed. Rita repeated the procedure with the other hand, with the same result. Bridget had set a cup and wet cloth down on the thin carpet.
Why did that work? I spoke the language of a soul.
Lightly, Rita began to massage the woman's temples, muttering again in the same language. Slowly, Sally's whole body relaxed. The spasm was broken. Rita held her hands about a centimeter to either side of Sally's head, then eased back and stood away from her.
What did you say? Essentially, I told her she was safe, and it was okay for her soul to come back home. Bridget, she knows you better than me. Best you comfort her, if you will.
It occurred to Bridget that she and the Snakefishville fugitive knew each other hardly at all, although she knew better than to discount the soul bonding of having faced deadly peril together. But they hadn't faced it very long, nor had great exposure to one another since. But quibbling didn't seem a good response. She cradled Sally's close-cropped, mousy blonde head against her bosom.
There, there. It's all right, Sally. You're safe. Everything's fine.
She looked up past Sally's crown at Rita.
I wish I could talk the language of the soul.
The sturdy blonde woman could do no more than silently shake her head. But skillful or not, Bridget's attempted ministration seemed to be working. Sally latched onto her arm with a double-handed grip that Bridget feared would leave her ulna permanently grooved. Wordlessly, Rita handed Bridget the porcelain cup and a fresh, damp hand towel. Bridget washed the woman's face again.
Better now?
Sally began to breathe more or less normally. The crushing pressure on Bridget's forearm eased. Then it was back, and Sally was staring into Bridget's green eyes with her own gray-blue ones, huge as a frightened kitten's.
Kane! I saw Kane!
Surely he's not that frightening.
No! Kane's in danger! They're going to kill him! I saw it!
A fist with knuckles like pebbles poking out through dense curling underbrush of black hair slammed the side of Kane's jaw and snapped his head around on his neck. Red and bright yellow lightnings flared behind his eyes. Slowly, he turned his face back toward his opponent, a man an inch or so taller than he and much heavier, although much of that was sagging around his waist. He was hairy enough for a balding mountain gorilla. The most prominent expanse of visible skin were his capacious gut and his face from halfway up his cheekbones to almost the crown of his head. Like Kane, he wore only a pair of trousers, these sun-faded blue cotton secured by a rope belt obscured from view beneath his gut. He was panting like a dog.
Is that the best you've got?
The man spread his arms. He had the arm span of a bull ape, too, and charged, roaring like a furious water buffalo. Kane stood and waited, almost as if lost in thought. As the huge, hairy arms began to curl in to encircle him in a spine-snapping bear hug, the former magistrate moved. He took a short step forward, using all his mass and a savage turn of his hips to power an uppercutting, palm-heel strike that slammed right up under the multiple black-bearded chins. Groaning, he raised his head from the marble as if it were a globe of condensed matter. Then his head fell back with a whump of finality.
Next?
You crazy.
Domi sat beside him on the carved marble bench. Her arms were crossed beneath her breasts, which were surprisingly full for her slight build. Not that anyone could tell for the sack she was wearing.
Yep.
He began to towel sweat from his shoulders and chest hair with a cloth she had waiting. Contestants and their supporters got reserved seating on stone benches in front of the box seats, it turned out. Wordlessly, she handed him a corked gourd. He uncorked it and tossed in a mouthful, swishing it around. Then he froze. His eyes blinked, went wide.
What the hell's that? Tastes like paint thinner.
Watered arrack. You just weren't ready for the taste.
That's alcoholic, isn't it? That's the last thing I need right now.
Water dilutes arrack. Arrack kills the germs. Win-win.
If you say so.
Not much alcohol. You can take it. You're strong, man. You'd rather drink raw fruit juice? Then next match, you can turn around, drop pants, and hose your opponent down with runny shit.
You're always a world of surprises, Domi. After all these years, you can still say things that flat-out revolt even me.
She crossed her arms again, even tighter than before.
Don't thank me. I'm just an outland gaudy slut. Maybe I should try for a spot in God King's harem. Be appreciated there.
Barons are hung like mice, you know that. Your time and talents would just be wasted. And thanks, Domi. I really do appreciate it.
He wasn't much concerned their seditious, or was it sacrilegious, banter might be overheard. For one thing, the next match was already in full swing. A tall, bulky, African-looking guy in olive silk pajamas fending off shin kicks from a bearded white dude in baggy shorts. Because they were close together, Kane and Domi could hear each other. But farther away than the few inches that separated them, their voices got swallowed up in the crowd's happy, gore-anticipating roar. To register applicants for the Grand Holy Fleet, as Reuben Goldstein said it was being called, a line of clerks sat behind a long table festooned with gold, white, and black bunting, the Dewa Raja's colors. When the bald, teak-colored man with a hat like a felt trash can on his shaved head, seated at one end of the table, gave him the squinty eye and cocked his pen peremptorily, Kane had spoken right up.
I'm Harden. I speak English. Anybody speak English here?
The pen flicked down the line. Four seats down, an albino dwarf waved a stubby hand at him from the shadow of a tattered yet tasteless red, purple, and green silk parasol, which also boasted a fringe of little yellow tassels, about a third of which were MIA.
What is it with dwarfs this month?
I speak Ingrezzi perfect, you betcha. What I can do you for?
Kane realized he was a eunuch as well as a dwarf. Cheer up, Kane told himself. It sucks to be you, but imagine being him. The albino eunuch dwarf might have overestimated his command of English, but it proved adequate to the task at hand. Kane recited the string of lies Goldstein and the Aborigines had cooked up for him over Arik. He had, so he said, seen service as a captain in the Sultan's own rifles in Singapura, had slain so many bandits, rebels, and, of course, sea dyaks. He had heard of the noble god king's great crusade and traveled here at great personal expense and danger to offer his sword to the heroic Dewa Raja, blah, blah, blah. The albino eunuch dwarf wrote it dutifully all down, or wrote something down. Peering at it, Kane couldn't tell if he had indecipherable penmanship or was writing in a non-Roman character set, or maybe he just couldn't read it upside down. Something in the dwarf's manner suggested very strongly that he knew Kane was reciting a string of lies, and whether he was writing them down faithfully or making up a whole new string of lies to amuse himself didn't mean shit to a tree sloth. All that mattered was that the requisite document be duly written down. Along with the flora and the natives, Kane noticed, bureaucracy had made quite the comeback after the new cost. The sun was dropping toward the forested hills west of Tanimbar City. The referee, a round-shouldered and moon-faced middle-aged man who looked Japanese and wore a black gi with a red belt, stood smiling blankly at Kane's side as they awaited the announcement of Kane's next match. His third, it was the final bout of the day. The winner would get the choice of moving on to the competition's next stage or taking the rank and prizes he'd won and bagging it. Kane was unsure what the matches needed a referee for, if there were any actual rules he hadn't seen them enforced. Domi had turned up a kid water seller with a gap in his teeth and another fez whose scanty possessions included a few scattered fragments of English. He had confirmed that that big four-armed muty bastard really had gouged out his opponent's eyes, both of them. It was considered unsporting to go for both at once, but the crowd loved it. The announcer was a squat, self-important man in resplendent robes of gold and black, who wore what appeared to be a double-decker trash can for a hat. Capacious as his own belly was, he obviously didn't eat much. There was little room left for niceties such as a stomach by the size of the lungs he had to have possessed, and these of rhinoceros hide. He was able to shout the whole damn crowd down. As impressive a feat in its way as any combat feats Kane had witnessed today. He finished bellowing in Malay, a language the day's other final competitor shared with the Tanimbar City mob. Then he set off roaring the whole spiel in almost comprehensible English as a ritual courtesy to Kane.
Captain Harden of Sultan of Singapore's own rifles.
Kane tuned him out to concentrate on taking deep breaths to oxygenate himself. His fights had been tough, but he hadn't taken much damage. His hard-contact, unarmed combat training had served him well.
And his opponent. Give it up, everybody, for Tanimbar City's own favorite son, Bandu, Lord of Rakshasa!
That doesn't sound good. Kane shook himself and focused his eyes upon the four-armed monster mounting the platform and cracking all four sets of knuckles. Grant sat and watched the sun immolate itself in the flames that consumed the dark's western peaks. A brisk breeze blew out into his face. Two swords rested on a rack before him, naked blades up to slice the sun's last rays. One long, katana, one short, wakizashi. Daisho, the long and short of it. The unique badge of the samurai, the noble warrior in service of old Japan. Shizuka had presented them to him as a token of his service to Nuedo. Knowing all they represented, he had accepted. The fiery and beautiful woman warrior had made the same offer to his blood brother Cain. Knowing all they represented, Cain had declined. Gracefully for Cain. Behind him, the barest breath of sound. The shadows made scarcely less noise racing toward infinity across the plateau that stretched forth from the entrance to Cerberus. But he heard, and the katana with its yard-long blade was in his hand. But he did not rise or even turn.
Will, I still might have shot you.
I would have sensed your intent, Rita.
I believe you would have done it that. But if you knew I was here, why'd you lay hand to the blade?
I never take anything for granted where survival is on the line.
He still hadn't turned his head. The sun expired in a glory of purple and gold. It would have made a tasteless painting.
Least of all when someone comes up behind me who hasn't exactly been generous with the truth.
The blonde Aborigine Farwalker sighed.
Will you bisect me if I sit beside you?
Not if you mind your manners.
Rita settled down into a squat at his side.
Tell me you didn't crack a smile when you said that.
It's beneath me to lie under the circumstances.
We've not lied to you.
Perhaps not directly. What about by omission?
Not even that, or so I believe.
At last he looked at her.
Do you think I'm stupid? You sure haven't told us everything.
Have you? You haven't exactly gifted us with your life story, Grant, my friend.
I doubt it's near as interesting as yours.
What would you have from me?
How about the whole story?
She looked at him. Her heavy hair shadowed her strong-featured face.
Have you really got time to hear 75,000 years of history?
Just the high points. What's with this 75,000-year thing you people keep going on about? What exactly happened 75,000 years ago, anyway?
We came to Earth.
One-on-one, Bandu didn't seem too overwhelmingly huge to Cain. No more imposing than, say, a minor skyscraper from a pre-Skydark ville. He loomed over the Outlander, grinning out of his brick-red face. His teeth appeared to have been filed to points, or maybe they grew that way. Cain Sin-Eater was back in Goldstein's basement in the custody of Tyree. He had assumed a modified boxer's stance, hands up and curved, about chin level. He had his head ducked somewhat forward, hoping the monster would try to punch down into his face so Cain could bust his hand by tilting his head a little more and taking the blow on the thick cap of his skull. Of course, with that mass and those muscles, conceivably Bandu was one of those rare specimens who could implode a human skull with a single blow of the fist. Bandu jabbed down with one of his left upper arms. Cain got his fists in the way and took a rocking blow to the pit of his stomach from the right lower arm. It missed the solar plexus, in part because Cain was standing slightly hunched forward, with his ribcage partly in the way to begin with. But it still blew the air out of his lungs and lifted him off his feet. He staggered back, just managing to stave off the reflex to drop his hands to clutch the world of hurt in his belly. Nonetheless, Bandu might have gotten quite a meal had he chosen to press his advantage. Instead, he went strutting around the platform's periphery, holding all four arms triumphantly aloft to invite the plaudits of the crowd, which were forthcoming. Cain promptly darted two steps forward and launched a savage sideways heel kick for the huge creature's right kidney with his left boot. Instantly, Bandu wheeled with breathtaking speed, both right arms lashing out backhand to swat his attacker. Suspecting Bandu's leaving his back unguarded had been a setup, Cain had already checked his forward motion and the kick, dropped his boot to the marble and ducked. He felt the breeze of passage of those colossal arms over his head, then snapped up to deliver a right roundhouse kick aimed for the nerve center right below Bandu's navel. The toe of his boot thunked home with satisfying impact, and Cain instantly danced back to avoid being grappled by the four arms that suddenly clutched for his rapidly retracted foot. He had either missed the nerve junction or the monster shrugged it off. Attacks like that affected standard humans in different ways, too. And who knows how this puke is put together, he wondered. The operative phrase being put together, Cain doubted the creature was a mutant. He suspected Bandu was a purpose-built biofact like the baronial guards. Cain was on his bicycle, circling backward and counterclockwise. The monster circled warily with him, treating his smaller opponent now with at least token respect. Why not have a whole bodyguard of these things, Cain wondered, knowing the God King's pavilion was surrounded by a phalanx of the normal human local ersatz mags. Probably too expensive.
Why run, little pale skin? You a coward!
Yep.
Bandu beckoned with all four arms.
Come to me. You cannot flee forever. I promise it will not hurt for long.
Either laughter really was the universal language, or the Anglophones in the crowd weren't pulling for Kane. But Kane knew Bandu was right. He couldn't run forever. He had no doubt that if he tried, the God King would quickly come to the conclusion that he wasn't officer material after all, and order his black turbans to serve a termination warrant on him, local style. He also knew he had little chance of dealing the giant any useful hurt with a straight-on attack. Got to be treachery, then. Kane grinned a wolf's grin. He loved it when that answer came up. Kane put his head down and charged at the monster. Bandu punched to meet him with his left-hand pair of arms. Huge and muscular as he was, he didn't omit to put his hips in it. Kane managed to take both shots on his forearms with his wrists crossed for bracing. They still blasted him clean over backward and sent him skidding across the smooth marble on his ass. One rule that did exist and was enforced. Unlike sumo, you could touch the platform with any part of your body as often and as hard as you liked and not lose, at least until something important caved in on unyielding marble. But like sumo, once you went out of bounds, that was it. And Kane was on a trajectory to stage dive right into the now howling mob. Only by rolling on his belly and sprawling his limbs to maximize drag did he save himself from flying into space. To his surprise, he found himself looking down into the upturned white oval of Domi's face.
Kane, you suck.
Strategy. Got him just where I...
Shit, Kane!
Her ruby eyes focused past him and her mouth opened in a gasp. Suddenly, her face was receding as if the earth had opened up and swallowed her. Or as if Bandu, moving with speed and stealth utterly unexpected in such a behemoth, had grabbed Kane from behind and military-pressed him right over his head. For a moment, he held Kane aloft, his lower hands bracing his upper elbows as he turned in a circle, playing to the mob. From here, he could slam Kane onto an upraised knee to snap his spine, always a crowd-pleaser, or just wham him down and let gravity and hard, smooth stone do the work. Either would leave Kane firmly ensconced on the last train headed west. Kane never knew which option the four-armed biofact opted for. He just felt Bandu begin to powerfully propel him down. He reached down himself to grab the luxuriant black ponytail hanging from the back of the monster's scalp with both hands. Bandu jackknifed violently as his very own strength and Kane's not-trivial mass yanked his head forward and down. Kane was slammed into redwood thighs. He clung to the hauser-thick hair, literally for dear life. Bandu toppled forward right on top of him, his forehead crunched into the marble with a mountainous thud. The monster had made an arch of himself, and so all his weight had not come down upon Kane, who lay beneath him. It didn't prevent most of the air from being mashed out of Kane's lungs, but he didn't let such a minor thing slow him down. Though blood was gushing everywhere from Bandu's head, that only proved what Kane already could feel. The monster wasn't chilled. His heart was still pumping it out. He was unquestionably stunned, which meant Kane had an opportunity that he had to seize. He slammed a hammer fist blow on the back of the unmoving giant's neck, mostly on principle. It produced no visible effect, and probably no actual one either, but it helped Kane wriggle free of the enormous mass weighing him down. From there, his vision going black, and his whole body feeling as if it had the vacuum of all space inside, he swarmed up to sit astride Bandu's barn door upper shoulders. Kane made himself grab the convenient handle the ponytail offered before he sucked in a huge breath. His head swam from the oxygen rush. He reared back, hauling hard, lifting Bandu's face from the scarlet pool on the marble. Then Kane drove himself forward, slamming the monster's face back down. He did that twice more. The huge body tensed once beneath him, filling him with terror that the beast was going to rear back and toss him like a bull. Instead, Bandu subsided with a sigh. Kane could still feel the monster's heart pounding through his own thighs, felt the bellows rise and fall beneath him. Bandu was still alive, but by now well and truly concussed, out of it. Kane sat upright and raised his arms in the air. After a heartbeat of unbelieving silence, the crowd erupted in applause. Kane felt his arm grabbed by the referee, who hauled him bodily to his feet with the arm above his head in the universal sign of victory. The ref let Kane's arm go. Kane took three steps to the edge of the dais, dropped to his knees, and puked.